State of Washington versus Michael Bailey. Are counsel ready?
Good morning. May it please the court, Jared Steed appearing on behalf of the appellant Michael Bailey. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, please.
Very well.
The issue in this case turns on the trial court's failure to adequately investigate whether jurors were unable to hear testimony crucial to the defense. Washington case law has established that an essential element of a fair trial is a jury capable of deciding the case based upon the evidence before it. Consistent with this right, when a juror cannot hear all the relevant evidence, a defendant is denied due process. In this particular case, several jurors, perhaps as many as six, were unable to hear at least part of Vail's testimony.
Would you agree that the evidence regarding what the jurors were able to hear or unable to hear was somewhat equivocal?
Not necessarily, Your Honor, no. We have here two affidavits, one from defense counsel, one from the defense intern, which indicated that, you know, based on his understanding and talking with the majority of the jurors, that his impression was at least half of them couldn't hear any of her testimony. Now, it's true that there were no...
Is it fair that the judge, as he apparently, as in fact the judge or neither of the attorneys, as they sat through the trial, saw no indication, at least there's nothing in the record that suggests that they observed any juror having any difficulty?
I think that's true from the perspective that they didn't personally observe the jury. You know, there's nothing in the record to suggest they were straining to hear. What the record does reflect, however, is that there were several times during Vail's testimony where the court had to ask her to speak up or testimony had to be repeated because there was difficulty having it picked up on the microphones and the parties couldn't hear it. So I think the record certainly supports that there were aspects of her testimony that, you know, didn't happen or didn't register, at least initially, and perhaps thereafter because of her soft-spoken voice or the adequacy of the recording device.
I saw three occasions of that during the course of her testimony over 2 days. Are there more than that you can point me to?
Your Honor, having gone through the record again, those are the three instances that I saw as well. You know, certainly I would suggest that just because something doesn't appear in the record doesn't mean that her testimony was, over the course of that 2 days, was picked up without issue thereafter. Certainly, I think that those three instances suggest that something wasn't working here, whether it was her voice or the recording devices, and it's certainly not unreasonable to suggest that if the parties in the court couldn't hear her, the jury, which was sitting even further away, couldn't as well. The main issue here is that rather than question the jury to determine exactly how many didn't hear what, if any, of her testimony.
And this hearing occurred a little over 2 months after the verdict?
My recollection, Your Honor, is that the verdict came out on June 7th. Defense counsel filed the motion pursuant to 7.5 on June 18th, if I'm not mistaken. So there was about a 10-day period after this when this happened. Off the top of my head, I would need to go back and look at the record to see exactly when the hearing occurred. I think, if I'm not mistaken...
I believe sentencing occurred on August 17th.
Right, and this...
And that was the same date as the oral argument.
Well, I'll double-check on that, Your Honor, and get back to you on rebuttal with that. But the issue here stems from the fact that rather than question the jurors...
But your proposal, then, is that the judge recall these jurors after some 2 months later to inquire.
Certainly, yes. There was an opportunity here to get to the bottom of it. While the trial was still relatively fresh in everyone's mind, the contact information of the jurors was available. It's not unreasonable to have an evidentiary hearing at that point to say, you know, what did you hear, what didn't you hear, to get to the bottom of the issue that's presented in this motion. Now we're dealing with a situation where, you know, we're almost 2 years removed from when this is going to happen, when this verdict came out.
Why didn't you just get affidavits from the jurors that you wanted to hear from or present something to the judge from? Why don't you just get affidavits and present those to the judge?
Well, Your Honor...
rather than trying to coordinate a day where everybody can get another day off work 2 or 3 months later or 4 months later or 5 months later by the time you can coordinate all of that to get everybody back in.
You know, the record doesn't reflect why affidavits weren't obtained from the jurors themselves. You know, we can speculate as to why that may be, but here we have an affidavit from trial counsel, which is an officer of the court. There's no indication in the record from the prosecutor or the court that the veracity of what is being asserted in these affidavits is somehow exaggerated or incorrect. So given the fact that defense counsel is an officer of the court, and there's no objection to what's contained in those affidavits, I think it's reasonable to suggest that those affidavits are factually correct as to what happened here.
And summoning everybody back in 3, 4, 5 months after the trial when it can be coordinated is an obligation that the trial court has. It's got to do that on its own even if it's not requested to.
Well, that's correct, Your Honor. That's the position we're taking. Is defense counsel brought a motion for new trial here based on the facts that, you know, the evidentiary hearing would have gone to, and that wasn't done. So, you know, the case law that is set forth in the briefing shows that other jurisdictions certainly indicate that in circumstances such as this, an evidentiary hearing is appropriate. And Jackson holds that an evidentiary hearing is the preferred course of action in a situation similar to this as well.
A lot of the cases cited are sleeping juror cases. And the advantage to a sleeping juror case is everybody's still there. And you can excuse whoever you have to excuse, and you can ask the jurors because they're still sitting there, you know, Mr. Smith, did you hear the testimony of Trooper Jones, or at what point did you doze off? And you can ask the jurors on either side, do you agree that that's the point on which they dozed off? And you can maybe correct that. But here we've got people back into the society. It's being brought up 2 months later. It's going to be some sort of time to bring them back. And there's no indication that anybody is really going to have anything to offer, because in terms of an offer of proof, there's nothing. In terms of what these people would testify to at an evidentiary hearing, isn't there some obligation to at least make an offer of proof before we drag people back into court 5 months after they completed their jury service?
Yes, I would agree with that, Your Honor, and I think the offer of proof here is what's contained in the affidavits from defense counsel and the intern. But again, to go to the sleeping juror aspect, you know, in Jackson we have an issue where something is happening after the fact. An evidentiary hearing is, you know, not even requested in that case, but the Court of Appeals, this court, is finding that an evidentiary hearing is the preferred course of action, even when we are removed, you know, several months from the time of the trial. And with that, I'll reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Good morning. May it please the court. Amy Meckling appearing on behalf of the State of Washington. And I'm asking this court to hold that the trial court properly, on the evidence that was before it in the motion for a new trial, exercised its discretion to deny the motion, and that it had no obligation on its own motion to bring the jurors back to court and question them about what they may or may not have heard. When a defendant brings a post-trial, post-verdict motion for a new trial, the onus is on him to produce some evidence sufficient for the court to find, to convince the court the merit of his claims. He has the burden of persuasion.
The prosecutor apparently was at this conversation with the jurors after the...
It's a little unclear from the record. It seems that way. It's unclear.
The declaration from counsel seems to say that both counsel were present.
If that's the case, then that's correct. I didn't see that. I was a little bit unclear about whether the prosecutor was there. Wasn't clear. I don't think
during
that
the course of the hearing, did the prosecutor ever confirm that these are things that the jurors expressed to defense counsel
during the oral argument on the motion for new trial? Yes, I think that's correct. I don't think the prosecutor didn't deny that those were accurate. So if he was there, then I think that what happened, and if you read the transcript of the oral argument, you know, the trial court specifically asked defense counsel, well, what percentage of the testimony didn't they hear? What did you, when they told you they couldn't hear, you know, what did you, basically, did you ask them to elaborate? And the defense counsel said, I didn't ask. I just assumed that half of them, meaning six, didn't hear any of it. And the trial court specifically rejected the notion that that was in any way reasonable for one or more, up to six jurors, not hearing a single word that the witness said, and nobody raised their hand or spoke up at the time to say, hey, I'm having trouble hearing, I can't hear. And I thought, if Your Honor saw three instances on the record, I would agree with that. I saw two. There may have been one more. But the inaudibles that are contained in the audio transcript, I would ask the court to find her not particularly relevant about whether the recording equipment picked it up, because whether the recording equipment picked it up is not the same as whether the people that were sitting there near her could hear. So I don't think that the fact that there are some inaudibles on the transcript, there are inaudibles on the transcript when everybody is speaking. Whenever you have an audio record, there's a lot of inaudibles. There, I noticed many during the court's comments, during counsel's remarks. So I noticed that the court, when the witness first sat down, asked her to pull the microphone closer to her, and then I think the prosecutor said, I'm having trouble hearing at one point, and they asked her to speak up. But other than that, there's no indication that anybody was having trouble hearing her at the time. And I find it completely unreasonable to think that as many as six, half, the jurors couldn't hear anything she said. And it's the defendant's burden to show that his rights to a fair trial were materially affected. And based on the record that the court had before it, he just didn't make that showing. And he didn't produce enough of an offer of proof for the court
you
to...
You agree she was, this witness was a critical witness for the defense.
She certainly, her testimony on its face certainly provided him with the defense to the crime, correct. I think that...
If we were to accept that the jurors were at least some portion of the testimony they were unable to hear, would that be sufficient?
For a new trial? No.
Why not?
I don't believe so. Because you have to look at the extent of the testimony that wasn't heard in the context of the evidence as a whole and make a decision based on that whether his right to a fair trial was materially affected. Keep in mind that this case did not depend on a credibility call between Ms. Val, I'm not sure how to say her name, and the victim. There was a plethora of other evidence that flatly contradicted her testimony and corroborated the testimony of the victim. There were two independent witnesses, one specifically who heard the crime happening and who placed a male at the scene, which Ms. Valley denied that there was a male there, telling the victim to remove his pants or he would cut him. There was the other witness to which the victim fled to his home after the incident and observed him basically in a state of shock over what had happened. There are text messages between Ms. Val and the defendant, Mr. Bailey, in the moments before this crime occurred that are strongly indicative of this crime about to happen, telling him, hurry up, just do it, because he got the chips on him, or CPIS, which is a spelling error. So there's a lot of other evidence that, including her own police statement, because keep in mind that she pled guilty and admitted that she robbed this man with Mr. Bailey.
So are you suggesting that any error in, any inability of the jurors to hear some portions of the testimony, even if that occurred, was harmless in this case?
I think so. I mean, I think it's difficult to know without knowing exactly what they didn't hear. I mean, that's sort of the problem that we're faced with, is we don't know what, if anything, they didn't hear. Did they miss certain words? Did they miss, you know, the very end of a sentence when she trailed off, and that, as that happens sometimes with witnesses? Did they miss whole paragraphs or, you know, whole comments? And I don't know. We don't know what they may or may not have heard. And it may be that off-the-cuff remarks by jurors to defense counsel after the trial, you know, why didn't you believe my witness? Well, you know, it's easier to say, had a hard time hearing her. If she was hard to hear, then I just didn't believe her. You know, what the jurors would say if they actually came to court and were asked to produce an affidavit with some sort of informality is a lot different than what they may have said to counsel in informal conversation. And we simply don't know what they didn't hear. But assuming that they didn't hear some material aspect of her testimony, I think that you have to look at what they didn't hear in the context of the evidence as a whole to determine whether or not he received a fair trial. And that's what the court's discretion would be exercised on. And the court simply didn't have a significant offer of proof to really be able to do that here. And Mr. Bailey never asked the court to bring these jurors back. In fact, what Mr. Bailey said at the end of the hearing was, well, could I get an order, you know, from the court for the juror contact information? And the court said, well, come back and see me if you can't get that information. Come back for the order if the jury room won't give it to you. Mr. Bailey, it's in a post-verdict situation, it's his burden to investigate claims for relief, potential claims for relief. It's not the court's burden at that point. In the sleeping juror cases, as Your Honor pointed out, these are pre-verdict. Everybody is still there, and the court has an obligation under the court rules and under the statutes to ensure that the jurors are paying attention and that they're fit for jury service. And if they're not, if they're sleeping, if they're inattentive, the court has an obligation to address it. That's not the case post-verdict. The court doesn't have an obligation to investigate avenues of relief for the defendant. The onus is on the defendant. And Mr. Bailey is not left without recourse. He can still, and maybe he has been over the last couple of years, trying to get more information to support a claim that would support some avenue of relief for him here. There's nothing to stop him from doing that. He can always bring a personal restraint petition with sufficient proof to address his claims, and the court can even, if he's produced sufficient evidence, the court can remand for an evidentiary hearing in that collateral attack. So he's not left without recourse. But here, what he's asking you to do is to find that in a motion for new trial, after the verdict, the court had an obligation on its own to bring the jurors back in 2 months after the trial had ended and question them based on a vague and speculative offer of proof. And that's just not a holding I think that this court should adopt. If you don't have any other questions, I would ask the court to affirm.
All right, thank you.
To answer your question, Judge Spearman, it does appear that the hearing did occur on August 17th. So we are, you know, a couple months removed here. But at the same time, we're still in a position of being able to get jurors in who are still relatively fresh in their minds with respect to what happened. Whereas now we're dealing with an issue that's, you know, almost 2 years removed from the situation at hand. And, you know, as Jackson points out, at that point, we've missed the opportunity for a evidentiary hearing because it's not reasonable to assume that they're going to be able to remember what happened 2 years ago, which is why
in Jackson there was actually declarations or affidavits from the jurors, at least one juror herself who actually gave that.
That's correct. There was one affidavit from a juror regarding the racial bias that was at issue there.
And there was no real countervailing evidence in that case either, was there? That's really
not that I recall.
All he had was that one juror's assertion.
That's correct. We're in a similar situation where an affidavit is offered here and the veracity of what's contained in that affidavit is not disputed.
But there is countervailing evidence. There's nothing in the record that suggests as the trial was proceeding that either the judge or either counsel had any observation of any inability of the jurors to hear the testimony.
I would agree with that, Your Honor, insofar as, again, there's no notation in the record as to specific actions the jurors are taking to hear the testimony, such as straining. But I disagree with that with respect to the fact that the record does reflect that there are several times that the witness is asked to speak up or repeat or there are inaudible. So certainly the record does support this assertion that things were being missed here for whatever reason, whether it's her soft.
I guess the question is whether three is several.
Well, three issues of having to repeat testimony or speak up, and then multiple inaudible. So, you know, at a minimum three, perhaps more. And
who was asking the witness to speak up?
Well, my recollection, Your Honor, is both the parties as well as the court. In fact, I seem to recall at least one instance where the court noted that the witness was soft-spoken and asked her to keep her voice up because the court was having trouble speaking.
So the court was attuned at least at one stage to this perceived difficulty, but when this was presented to the trial judge, the trial judge's take on it was that the assertion that six people hadn't heard a thing was not credible based on what he had observed in his own courtroom over the course of the trial. Isn't that evidence contrary to the truth of the evidence in the affidavit such that it supports the trial court's decision not to go further with this?
No, Your Honor, and I assume I'm about out of time, but if I could answer this one question. The court here is rejecting the notion, or at least suggesting that it's unreasonable to assume that six jurors didn't hear any of her testimony. The court is not suggesting that it's unreasonable to believe that as many as six jurors, or at least some, didn't hear part of her testimony. And the problem in this case is the juror is pointing out the unknown here. We don't know how many jurors missed what. And it's that fact. It's the fact that the court is okay with entering an order denying the motion for new trial without getting to the bottom specifically of what actually happened here. with respect to how many jurors heard what part of her testimony. Everyone agrees it's the testimony here is crucial to the defense. The question is how do we move forward denying this motion for new trial? And our position is it's unreasonable to do that without answering that question through an evidentiary hearing. So for those reasons, we'd ask that you grant Mr. Bailey a new trial. Thank you.
Thank you.
Our next matter, Scott Anderson, Truck.